Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that this show brings on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And remember, if you can't listen live, go to our website at answers.network and browse a variety of that you will find something that will bring you greater joy, either to you or to someone you know. Now, I also have a favor to ask. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we can make a positive difference in the world together. And I guarantee you, if you are interested in the future, then you know somebody who can benefit from this show. This is something that is going to be able to reach all of us. The topic of our show today, which is also the title of our guest book, is The Super Age, Decoding Our Demographic Destiny. Brad Sherman is a demographic futurist, an opinion maker on all things dealing with the business of longevity. Do a lot of studying on longevity. Now, Brad is based in Washington, D.C., and he is a sought-after speaker all over the world. He's a social connector who has built his reputation by helping leading organizations harness the opportunities that are given to us throughout the world. Brad, welcome to Answers Network.
Thanks for having me, Alan.
All right. And as I was just telling you, but I want to share with the audience, for those of you that or maybe newer listeners and haven't heard me talk about it, but I do get questions, and the show is Answers. I get questions for years. Why did I start this show? I'm an international detective. I travel around the world. Why did I decide to start a show that originally was Answers for the Family and is now Answers Network? And it's because I listened to a futurist. I was in Hawaii about 13 years ago, and he said that in the future, all radio will be internet-based. And I thought about it, and as soon as I flew back, I started looking around for who might be doing this in Southern California. I found Sam Hassan, who's the owner of our network, and I've been there ever since. So, Brad, one of the things is that if people will listen to futurists, you might find something that helps you change the course of your own future. So thank you.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think not all futurism is equal though. I mean, the mm-hmm. futurism that I hope to bring to the table, that I hope I bring to the table with the book is one that offers a realistic picture of the future with both paths for optimism and pessimism. But it's deeply rooted in data and hard science. I can't share with you.
Yeah, and with and being the investigator and reading your book and the fact that you have data to back everything up was so nice for me, because one of the frustrations for me is when people just kind of blurt something out and you ask why and they go, because I think so.
Right.
I need more than that. So again, for those of you that are like me, and I know there's also a lot of detectives, a lot of law enforcement, a lot of teachers that listen to the show. That's one of the beautiful things about this book is that it's backed up by data. So Brad, one of the things that you talk about and in your book is you talk about this is a remarkable time in history. So share with us a couple of the opportunities that this remarkable time affords everyone that most people don't realize.
Well, it's not just a remarkable time in history, it's a first time in history for us, mm-hmm. a first time in the history of the world where at least one out of five people will be over the age of 65. That'll happen in this country in just 8 short years. It's already happened in places like Japan and Germany and Italy, where populations have exceeded 20% of the population over the age of 65. And believe it or not, it's happening locally here already across the country. In fact, a third of all U.S. counties now meet this designation, and five states, including Maine, Vermont, West Virginia, Delaware, and Florida. So this new era where our populations will be older is really something unique for us. Mm-hmm. And it isn't just the fact that they're older. It's the fact that we're living longer. We're living healthier than we ever have been. But in order to really capture the promise of this new period of humanity, we have to make some adjustments to our systems. We have to think differently about life and how long we'll work, perhaps taking on one or two careers at least throughout the duration of our lives. We'll have to think about lifelong learning as being something that's a central tenet to how we get by. We'll have to think about shifting family structures and shifting landmarks in terms of what we expect to achieve throughout our lifetime. Marriages are already being delayed. Childbearing is already being delayed. What else will happen? Mm-hmm. But I want to make sure that people understand one important part of this. This super age that we're entering into isn't just about a lot of extra older people being around. Obviously, that's a key part of it. But the more important, the more exciting thing is that every time we extend human longevity, every time we increase lifespan, we're not just tacking years on to the end. We're actually pushing really healthy years into the middle. So for all of us, we're getting a better, longer life at the end of the day. And I think that's a great deal.
No, and I love that you touch on that, because again, when I am on the show talking about longevity, and I get people that will send in either questions or comments, and they'll say, well, you know, you talk about, you know, living into triple digits and everything else, but I don't want to live into triple digits if I'm going to be hooked up to a machine or in a bed. But what you said is exactly the point that I bring up, is that, no, we're talking about not just longevity, but increasing our health span as well. And that's what I think is incredible. Talk a little bit about also the experience that we're able to continue to either keep in the workplace or at least keep available to those that are still trying to work.
Yeah, I obviously think that there are some adjustments that need to be made here, both from an employee perspective, but also an employer perspective. And the reality is we just have to work longer. Mm-hmm. I know people don't like to hear that up front, but when you dig into the reality of working longer, it becomes a lot more pleasant. Not only does it keep us connected as consumers, but believe it or not, it's actually good for our health. Not just our economic health, but also our physical health. We stay healthier longer when we're engaged in work. Men in particular really reap health benefits from being engaged in employment, in large part because it drives socialization. We build our social networks within working environments. So by staying engaged for longer periods of time, whether that's full-time, part-time, volunteer, gig, or anything in between, it's typically good for us at the end of the day. And yes, there are always going to be those people that say, man, did I love retirement? Boy, do I love retirement. Those multiple rounds of golf each day, that really makes my life purposeful. That gives it meaning. But I can show you 9 others out of that 10 that will say otherwise, that will say they missed something about their working years. So as we enter this new period, we have to reimagine what work actually looks like, working in a completely different profession than you did before. Maybe it is taking on a different role within your enterprise. Maybe with the teachers or the law enforcement officers that you have on here, it's supporting those networks that they worked in for years in just a different capacity. All of that is possible in the future.
Yeah, and you touched on, and which you also touch on in the book, the concept of multiple careers, that we've gotten away from the you get one job and you stay in it. Mm-hmm. And for those people that are thinking, no, I don't, you know, I don't want to keep working. I've been going all my life to reach that retirement point, is maybe just change how you look at it. Don't look at it as working. Look at it as finding a way to gain an income from something that you love.
Yeah, and it's not just income, it's purpose. Yes. And it's interesting, within our language, within the English language, we don't really have a good word for this. I mean, purpose is a word. The French have the raison d'être, the reason for living. The Japanese have ikigai, which is this kind of balancing of purpose and life and work all together. And we, as people, as individuals, can really seek this out in a much more holistic way. And I think that we're coming to a point, almost a breaking point, where this work to live and live to work is actually going to be sparkled with or smattered with more purposeful vocations throughout. And that's, again, a good deal for us.
No, I agree. One of the things that you touch on in the book is you talk about trends. You go talk about the trends right now in cars or fashion and housing, and that, you know, currently that we're about ready to break sales records. How much of this is driven by inflation, and how much do you think, or how do you think is going to be where we're going to have a correction soon or a crash? A lot of people talk about it. Obviously, the news talks about it. And along with that, also talk about how it actually can bring communities closer together.
Sure. Well, I think from an economic standpoint, a couple of things are happening here. Our systems are predicated on growth, and mostly population growth, workforce and labor force participation growth. That's how our systems are designed. And in fact, for most of the 20th century, for all of the 20th century, in fact, we were growing. And we were growing at an exponential rate. So around the turn of the last century, from 1900, at the 1900s mark, we were at about 1.8 billion people. But today we're approaching 8 billion people rather quickly. That's a remarkable feat. So for all of these decades, we've had this glut of consumers, we've had this glut of workers that have actually driven down costs overall. Well, during the pandemic, not only did we have these forces that were dragging down trade, making the supply chain more challenging to fulfill its promise, but also we had a lot of workers leave. A lot of people retired. They left because they were forced out, or they left because they were fearful of their health, or they just thought it was a good deal at the time to walk away. Mm-hmm. But this left a hole in our employment system that really drove up labor costs. And labor costs are a driver of inflation. So when will the bow break? We will see a correction sometime soon. The marketplace goes in cycles like anything else. The big question is, where will it snap first? But we will see a correction in the near future. And that shouldn't worry you, Alan. I mean,
what I'm saying is, can you narrow down the term near future?
I would say that it largely depends on what's happening in Ukraine right now, that will drive the stability of the marketplace. And this is where the crystal ball becomes a little harder to see through, when you have a number of extenuating factors that are running into demographic patterns at a pretty fast rate. Most of my predictions in the book were updated because of the pandemic. But prior to the pandemic, you know, most of these things that we're experiencing right now, we weren't expecting to experience for another 10 years or so following the demographic patterns. But of course, when you have disruptive events, that can throw off the path of certain other events. So we have to be cautious of those. So when taking a look at the larger marketplace, we're seeing a real flood of cash into a house right now. There are specific housing bubbles that have really popped up in other markets that make the one here look tame. China's in particular is very dangerous right now. I think where we'll see most of the economic stability in the near future will be coming out of China, because their demographic population mix is just a bit weaker than ours. But it doesn't mean that if China doesn't catch a cold, we won't too. We've seen that happen throughout the past 2 years.
Right. So you think, as far as a correction, that it will occur in China first?
Yes.
And then there'll be a ripple effect, I guess, you know, as it goes through the rest of the world.
The question is, how big will the ripple be? You know, China's economy has really slowed down during the pandemic for a number of different reasons. But China's demographic profile has really changed too. You know, China is one of the few countries that actually suffered from population decline entry to experience that. It will obviously become a lot more common in the super age as populations age out, as we start to shrink as a global society. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but based on our structures that are predicated on growth, it is. We'll see it as a negative in the near future. Whereas in terms of the long-term future, it's actually a real net positive at the end of the day.
Well, if I could hand you the magic wand, and you could make some decisions or policies, what are some of the ones that you would make that would start steering us in the right direction?
My immediate investments would be in rural America, first and foremost. And in terms of a Tennessee Valley Authority type approach to digitization of those environments, making sure that those communities have access to at least 5G technologies so that they can stay attached to and compete with the global economy. Also, that offers incentives for people who have migrated to the coast, reasons to move back into the center. Having a good age mix within a community is part of what makes a community healthy. Right now, across rural America, we're really struggling with keeping populations up. You're seeing a population that's very old and very white and very monocultural. And there's nothing wrong with that being the reality. It's just not a sustainable reality for these people and these towns across the country. And in a state like Iowa, 99 of their counties are in population decline right now. That's not good for a state long term, and it has a ripple effect, obviously, like anything else. First you see the schools closed, then you see the post office, then you see the bank, then you see the retail environments. All of this stuff kind of falls around these towns if you don't keep them up and keep them flush. I also think we need to make some critical investments in lifelong learning. It's nothing short of insane that we spend the amount of resources that we do of getting people into adulthood, but we do nothing afterwards. We prepare no one for elderhood. We prepare no one for middle life. We prepare no one for getting old. Those types of resources we need to have in place. And the last part is we really need to make critical investments in our infrastructure to allow for mobility, getting people from point A to point B. Right now, if you live within an urban environment, you have great access to transportation. But the further you get outside of there, the more reliant you are on a car. Well, guess what happens when people get older? The first thing they lose is their mobility, their ability to get around. So we want to be able to have that ability, that reality for folks, no matter where they live. And obviously, automation within cars is a promise for the future. But going back to the first point, it can only happen if the right digital networks like 5G are in place.
Makes perfect sense. One of the things that I was looking into was, and correct me if I'm wrong with any of this, but that Amazon was experimenting with drone delivery, and I think it was in 13 middle-sized cities, so more middle America, middle size, rather than focusing on the large cities. That seems consistent with what you're saying is that if we can have drone delivery for things, that's going to certainly help the potential mobility problem.
It will help the mobility problem. I think what you're finding is that we talk a lot about getting to scale these days. How do you get a business to scale? One of the easiest ways you get a business to scale is within an urban environment where you have a dense population, rather. The further outside of that, the harder it is to scale, the harder it is to find efficiencies. So with something like drone delivery, you can improve efficiencies by automating things that a human being would do otherwise. That's going to be a central tenet to our immediate future is the further automization of jobs. And don't think that's a bad thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Automation, mechanization of jobs has been something that's been around since the start of the first industrial revolution, and that was in the 1760s. So this is something that we should all be very comfortable with. We don't worry about the need to have horses and a stable in our backyards anymore. And a horseman to take care of those horses, and a stableman to take care of the stable, and a man to run the carriage. We don't have to worry about it anymore. We hop in a car. So these types of automations, this path that we've been on of motorizing and automating things has been around for a very long period. It's not going away. Some jobs will, but that's always been the case as we've moved forward. Guess what, though? Other jobs will emerge. They always do. What's scary for people right now is that it's just happening so quickly. And that's what happens during industrial revolutions. And we're in the fourth one right now. So while it may seem overwhelming at times, All of it's happening and it's happened before.
Well, and one of the issues I know that we're also having right now is supply chain issues. And Brad, I live on the West Coast in a beach community where I drive along the coast, the Pacific Coast Highway, nearly every day. And we see cargo ships that are backed up for as far as the eye can see. I tried counting them. I can't count them because I know they're still there. I just can't see that far.
Right.
So what are your thoughts on this problem? And how do you see this playing out in the near and further future? Because it sounds like with what you're saying with automation, we may be behind in certain areas to allow this to happen.
Well, things are going to start coming home. That's what we have to remember and in fact get very excited about, is that a lot of that manufacturing will be returning to our shores. I think that if we've learned anything about this period is that while we do depend on a global economy, we do need domestic stability of products and services. We need things to be made here, like light bulbs, for example, which are very hard to find made in the U.S. anymore. This is part of our should be part of our defense protection for the country, is to have production defense as well. The ability for individuals to be able to buy food without having a challenge to it. And this is one way to get there, is by bringing more of this manufacturing, bringing more of this production home. Now, people don't always like to hear something like this because it sounds contrary to this march towards globalization that we've been on for quite a significant period of time. But it's not anti-globalism. I don't want there to be any misconstruction of my argument here. It's actually pro-globalism, but it's also pro-America. And there is one way to get behind this, and it's by engaging in a support of our domestic industries as much as we can.
Yeah, when you mentioned, like you mentioned light bulbs, well, you know, one of the reasons why I'm told, you know, that automobiles are so expensive now is the fact that we can't get parts because we don't make any of them here anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, NAFTA was less impacted by COVID than other trade networks, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't impacted at all. I think what you'll see is that supply chains will change; they'll adapt. Where you'll have local manufacturing centers. What we've all come to realize, I think, during COVID is that China cannot be our warehouse. China cannot be our manufacturing center. And you're already starting to see outward migration of those types of things from China into other marketplaces that can handle them, if only because it diffuses the opportunity for disruption. We want to have things move slowly from place to place in order for our economy to continue functioning at its optimal levels. So if one thing shuts down where everything is made, that's a big problem for us at the end of the day. So, I would say that what we can expect in the future is that more of that manufacturing will return home. But let's be clear here, for anyone who's listening or watching today, we're not necessarily returning to the glory days of American manufacturing, because so much of it will actually be automated at the end of the day. So the types of jobs that we'll see in factories won't necessarily be those well-paying union jobs that we saw in the 1950s, the 1960s. Those jobs are largely gone. But what does come in place are highly technical, highly skilled jobs that might pay a lot more. There'll just be fewer of them.
Yeah, and that makes sense. You mentioned earlier that a lot of this is going to stem on what happens in Ukraine. Let's talk a little bit more about that in regards to what exactly does it mean? Meaning that if it goes a longer period of time, it's going to affect us more in the negative, or is it more based on if it escalates beyond Ukraine? What are your thoughts as to what could happen that would make things work better, and what can happen that can make things work worse for us?
It's really the latter, quite frankly. The latter is that if it extends outside of the current engagement zone, if Ukraine, you know, spills over into Poland, into Belarus, then we start having some bigger problems. If it gets into Germany or even nips at China, then we've got a more significant escalation of the problem. Obviously, if China makes a grab for Taiwan during this period, that's going to cause this to spill over into a global conflict. And that's where we get into just complete unknowns, because we've been through two world wars. We can see what they look like, but we've never experienced one with this level of technological sophistication, nor have we ever lived in a world before that's been this connected, both in terms of technology and communications, but also, like we say, in the supply chain. You know, there's a lot that would have to turn around relatively quickly in order to stabilize markets. And markets don't turn on a dime. Industries don't turn on a dime to meet the needs of the future. There are obviously things that have to come into play, like skilling up a workforce, building factories and the like. So we would have a period of some pain, most likely, if this conflict continues to grow. I'm hopeful that it stays contained at this point. Mm-hmm. But it just takes one bad actor. It takes one mistake. It takes one missile flying over the border into a place it doesn't belong. One rogue actor. Mm-hmm. We have to remember that, you know, wars were started with far less than a bomb hitting the wrong target. You know, you have to remember that the First World War was started with Archduke Ferdinand being shot in Sarajevo. So it's only going to take one action for it to spill over. And I'm hoping that cooler heads will prevail at the end of the day.
Well, I am right there with you on that. We are speaking with Bradley Sherman, and we are talking about the future. And we're going to take a break, go out there, contact some of the people that you know. For everybody out there that's listening, if you want to know more about some of the things that may be in our future, let them know that they can tune in now. And we're going to talk a little bit more about, supply chain. We're going to talk more about retirement. We're going to talk about a lot of things that are going to have a bearing on our future. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. We are speaking with futurist Bradley Sherman, and we're talking about really his new book, but it's The Super Age, which is Decoding Our Demographic Destiny, which takes in a lot of stuff. So, Brad, one of the things that I want to talk about, and I don't know that it necessarily falls under demographics, but which has to do with happiness. So countries like Bhutan, Norway, Sweden, and such, they rank way ahead of the United States when measuring a country's happiness quotient, and they actually measure that. What changes, policies, or programs would you make to steer the U.S. in that direction?
Well, that's a hard one for the U.S. because we're so focused on money here. And, you know, money's never really made anyone sad, but it doesn't necessarily drive happiness either. With that in mind, you know, when we move into this new era, when we may have shrinking marketplaces, you know, there's only a couple ways that we can continue to grow economically. And one of those is through finding efficiencies. But even that will likely dry up at some point. I can't give you a specific timeline on that, but it will. I am impressed by the countries that you mentioned, but more likely a country like New Zealand that actually has put in place a happiness index and actually has government spending built around happiness and well-being. Because, you know, GDP as a measure, as a sole measure for a country, is really fraught with a lot of problems. It doesn't make us, as a society, do the right kinds of investments in infrastructure, in people, in supporting the lives of our families and our communities. And I believe that under the Ardern government in New Zealand in particular, they've taken some pretty significant steps to address both happiness as well as well-being for their populations, both now and in the future.
Well, I hope that we can learn something from them, because you know, and I've been blessed with the ability to travel and to go to some of these places, and you know, there are policies that can be put in place that can shift. But unfortunately, I think that the current system that we have going is that they're very happy with the way that they have it and not really that concerned with how it relates to everybody else.
So. Well, and I think, you know, like anything, we go through cycles and we are entering a new cycle right now. And it's a cycle that will largely be driven by demographics. In fact, I think almost everything in our world is driven by demographics, mm-hmm. Or demographics at least have some influence on everything that we do, because we are people and people mm-hmm. are connected. With that in mind, though, when we think about what the future of our own well-being means, I think the communities are going to have an outsized impact in our future. Whereas we may not see major shifts in government policy in the near term, I do think we're going to see some real changes in the way our communities behave. I think we're going to shift away from warehousing older people in nursing homes, which has become the de facto rule in this country. And I'm not placing any value judgment on here on families that need to have their loved ones in nursing care. But as a general rule of sidelining older populations into 50 plus communities or nursing type facilities, I think that's going by the wayside. And it will largely be driven by the fact that it's simply too expensive for us to manage anymore. The government can't afford it. Individuals can't afford it. So we'll most likely be moving back, at least most of us will be moving back into a reality where many of our will move with us at the very end when they need that hospice level or nursing level type care that a family cannot deliver anymore. But in terms of the change is going to happen locally first. It's going to happen on our streets, within our towns, our villages, and our cities first.
Well, I certainly hope so. Well, we have some questions and comments that have come in. And again, I want to thank those people that take the time to send them in. And this one reads, can you elaborate about your comment that retirement needs to be rethought? In 3 years, I will be one of those individuals joining the Social Security pool. I am anxious to get your views on where we are headed and if you see the system surviving. And this is from Karen in New York.
Well, Karen, I wish I had your age, if only because I could give you a better idea of what you should consider. But as
I was going to say, Brad, I think I'm going to guess her age, because if we use the number 65, it says that she's 3 years from it. So let's.
Well, if we use that number.
If we use that number, exactly. What I'm saying is that at least if you have a starting point.
So I would think
those other people that are in that realm, I think, can do it.
I would say what most people don't realize about Social Security is that you can take it as early as 62.
Yeah.
And as I think it's as late as 70, you can start. Wait as long as possible. If you can wait until 70, wait. Okay. Do not take early Social Security. Do not do it. It's a Trojan horse. It is a big, big problem for your long-term finances. Wait as long as you can to exit the workforce. And like I said, this will have a significant impact on your monthly earnings from Social Security. It will help the overall system remain flush and healthy. And more than anything else, it'll keep you healthy because you'll be staying engaged in work for a longer period of time. So if I can offer any suggestion to anyone who's listening to this that's approaching retirement age, is wait. Wait as long as you can to exit, because the impact on you long term is substantial. Do not exit early. Do not, do not, do not.
Well, and let's stay on that subject of retirement, because you talk about it in the book, and I've also listened to some of your speaking engagements, and you've spoken on it. What would you like to see done to bring a new concept of retirement into the 21st century?
Well, I mean, I think in the most perfect world, and we're starting to see it emerge in some sporadic cases of the ability for people to exit the workforce at their own pace. Some choice in our own path. We shouldn't have to say, I'm going to be Social Security today, I'm going to be retired today, and I'm going to stop working tomorrow, or vice versa. We should be able to say, I want to choose my path of exit. And we should be able to work with our employers to do so. Now, here's the good news. This is really good news. Because of the shift in the workplace, because of the reality that both Gen Z and Gen Alpha, which are the generations behind millennials, they are significantly smaller in size. That means that workforce demand for older workers will be on the upswing. And because of that, employers will be looking for ways to include you, those over the age of 65, in the workforce for longer periods of time. That means you'll likely have a greater opportunity to choose your own adventure, how you work within an employment and work with an employer on securing your future. Now, each one of you have an approach to what you may want 30 hours a week. Some of you may want something in between. Some of you may want to get off the factory floor, off the beat, out of the classroom, and move into a more managerial type role, or maybe a job sharing role. All of this is doable. That's the great thing about a novel period, is that we can find novel solutions to meet it head on.
Yeah, and as you were saying, that thought that was coming to mind is, you know, when you've worked at that job for however many years, maybe consulting is the way to go. Let the young people come in and do the, quote, heavy lifting, and consult and use your knowledge, and maybe that allows you to stay in the workplace longer as well.
Exactly. And we're already seeing that happen. So in a country like Japan, where one out of three people is over the age of 65, some companies have already taken advantage of this talent pool. In fact, Mitsubishi Industries, which actually has a consultant pool that's made up exclusively of men and women over the age of 65. And it works. It works because people choose their own hours. They choose their own projects that they want to get onto. They're not tied down to anything in particular other than what they want to do. And it offers a great way to transfer knowledge between one generation to another. It builds up continuity in business operations. And more than anything else, everybody comes out on top with it. Everybody wins. So when we look at what our future looks like, it's finding these solutions that are really just right there in front of us, really quite obvious to the trained eye, but maybe a little less obvious to others. But they're right there, and we can do them. They're doable, they're cost effective, and they make sense.
So, and when we were talking about the book, and we were saying how you back everything up with numbers, which you know, with facts or numbers or some sort of correlations of demographic numbers that are similar, that most of us, as I was reading, I'm like, I would have never thought of that. So share some of the things to where, you know, the correlation of demographic numbers are similar, but yet, you know, you've figured out how that equates to something else, and yet most of us wouldn't have ever thought about that.
It's a broad question, so I'm going to give you a broad answer. Okay. In terms of history, you know, many people, most of us have grown up in a world where older people really feel pushed away by society. We feel like people over a certain age, whether that be traditional retirement age of age 65 or even earlier, are really pushed out of the workforce. That's all we've experienced in our lifetime. But the reality is that not that long ago, in fact, as early as 1950, there was a nearly 50% participation rate of men over the age of 65 in the American workforce. That's amazing. By 1990, it was 14%. And we've clawed up to about 20% today. But I expect that number to just explode. And in fact, I'm not the only one. In fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics suggests that the 75-plus workforce will double in size by the end of this decade.
Wow.
So get ready to work longer. It's coming because the opportunities are going to be there for us. And I think we should all be really thrilled about that because opportunity means everything because it'll give us a sense of purpose and a sense of belonging and hopefully a sense of contributing to something more again in the future. But yeah. let me put a very fine point on this. When I talk about the novelty of this period, it isn't just that there are going to be a lot more older people. It's also going to mean that there's a lot fewer younger people too. Okay. So there are two generations that are behind us that are shrinking in size, millennials and Gen Alpha. So whereas the 75 plus workforce will nearly double by the end of this decade, the under 25s will actually contract by about 7.5%. So we are going to start seeing some contraction in the labor market too. We'll obviously buffet that with some immigration to some extent, but it won't fill all the gaps. So expect for, you know, the system to look for talent where it needs to look, and that's within older populations.
Well, and if I can speak directly to a lot of the employers out there, there are some cultures that put such incredible value on experience or the older worker. And I know that when I was in the lease and I was, you know, I would go from like village to village and we would sit and they would entertain us because I was with one of the royal family, and kids would run up behind me and they would touch the back of my head. They mm-hmm. would touch my hair and I would turn and I would look, and it was a little disconcerting at first. And finally I asked one of the locals there and I said, I'm looking at everybody else. They're doing it to me. I said, why are they doing this? And they said, you have gray hair. And they said, there is a belief within their culture that just touching that gray hair will give wisdom to them.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the funny thing about our history with old age is that it's been consistently inconsistent. You know, yeah. men in power have always had a very nice role in terms of being old. Women have not necessarily experienced the same level of admiration in later life. And also it was quite rare that people made it to old life, but it doesn't mean that there weren't old people. You know, Michelangelo was 88 when he died, and he was painting the Sistine Chapel when he died. So it's not like these are new things to live to a ripe old age. It's simply the fact that there are so many of us doing this. And by 2034, if you can believe this, people over the age of 65 will actually outnumber those under 18. That's just 12 years away. So this is a significant transformation of our society that's underfoot. And mm-hmm. when you start linking together the data points, when you start connecting the dots about what this could mean for us, it is quite a dramatic shift. But like I said earlier, you know, this is really happening unevenly across the country. Rural communities in particular are being hit. Urban ones at a delay, a significant delay. In fact, Washington, D.C., which is where I live, we only have 12% of our population over the age of 65. Only 12%. But you take a look at other counties across the country, and there are counties where the 65 plus population is 30 to 35%, just like Japan. Mm-hmm. So we can't look at this as necessarily even across the United States. That's a very important thing to remember here, is that each region has its own specific challenges, and each region will develop its own specific solutions and find its own opportunities.
Well, and we're seeing that now. So here in California, we have, you know, it's, I think, one of the few times in which the population here is going down rather than up. It's been going up forever. And I have quite a few friends, and you mentioned Tennessee earlier, quite a few friends that are all moving to Franklin, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it is happening. We've got about 4 minutes and left, but we've got another question. And this one reads, things are changing rapidly, and many of us are seeing fuel costs continuing to rise, food scarcity at local grocery stores, as well as other economic sectors reporting hard times ahead. How do you recommend we prepare for drastic changes such as these? What kinds of advice does your book offer, as I would like to get a copy and add it to my collection? And this is from Grady in Texas.
Oh, Grady, thank you for the question. You know, one of the things we always have to prepare for is the inevitable and the unexpected. And that's obviously being driven by our ability to be resilient as individuals, but also really to be economically resilient. And when I talk about working longer, it isn't just about doing it for the health purposes. It isn't just about making more money. It actually builds greater resiliency for you as an individual too, especially as you enter hard economic times like we're entering right now, with the cost of goods going up, with some scarcity in the marketplace, because those people that are employed at least are having an income stream. Those folks that enter retirement are often put onto, or at least entering into, a period of fixed income. And as we know, the government can only move so fast to deliver relief, and offering a cost of living adjustment in the middle of such an inflationary period is very difficult for the government. It rarely happens. So, you know, my bit of advice, which may sound a little hollow right now, is to stay employed, diversify your earnings as much as you can, in order to meet some of the immediate challenges that are before us. But like anything, we will get through this period, but it will be a bit bumpy for the next couple of years, I think.
Well, Bradley, I am just so thankful that you have written the book. I'm glad that you came on the show, and I would love to stay in touch and maybe have you come on from time to time and give us some updates.
Well, I'd love to do that. And I hope all of you that are listening today do pick up a copy of the book. You can obviously find it on Amazon, as well as Barnes & Noble and your local retailers. And of course, you can find me at thesuperage.com.
That's great. And again, everybody, yeah, that's The Super Age, Decoding Our Demographic Destiny. Bradley, thank you so much.
Thanks, Alan. It was great being here today.
All right. And for everybody out there, be sure that you join us next week, when we're going to have J.O., who is the author of Maximizing Your Medicare. So it's the 2021 edition in regards to qualifying for benefits, protecting your health, and minimizing your cost. And it's interesting. We just got finished talking about the fact that we have a very large over 65 population. Well, we're now going to talk about how we can help ourselves. I'm also very close to that as well. So for everybody, be with us next week. And also, go to Answers Network, go to our archives, or just subscribe to the show, because you can do so on iTunes, on iHeart, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, and so many more. you can also find us on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, and share it with your friends. We are trying to put out information out here that will help everybody. And that's the goal. So the more that you can help us, it's how we can make a positive difference together. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us next week on Answers Network.
Here, apply this to anywhere it hurts. It'll reduce your physical pain.
Thank you, Sensei. What about the emotional pain?
We'll learn to block a slap.
You don't spar with the Sensei.
Marty's Cobra Cove has no mercy on me. Don't rub it off. Rub it in.
Listen only on LA Talk Radio.